This week on the BOAG World Show, we talk imposter syndrome, whether designers should code, inspiration standards, and making a contribution. This week's show is sponsored by Video Blocks and Currency Fair. BOAG.com, the podcast about all aspects of digital design, development and strategy. My name is Paul BOAG, and joining me this week on the show is Andy Clark from sunny Australia. Hello, Andy.
Good day, mate.
Good day. And Rachel Andrews from the US of A. Well, actually currently in the US. I don't want to imply you're American, Rachel. Sorry.
No, I'm definitely a Brit, but I'm currently sat in a hotel room in San Francisco where it is almost 9 a.m. in the morning.
Oh, and we've got Sam Barnes and Marcus Ellington from the heart of the great British Empire. Hello, guys.
Hello, Paul.
And I'm sitting in an Airbnb in London. So we are spread all over the place. There is, out of the five of us, three of us are currently travelling. That is the rock and roll lifestyle we lead.
So it how is everybody? Tuesday in Australia?
No, it's not.
It is.
Now, that's just confused. That just hurts my head.
Yes, the going forward in time is terrifying. I'm, like, behind. I'm in the past, which
that's
is
okay.
Where I usually am, to be honest.
Yeah. But, no, that's not right. No, because I'm confused. Because Andy says it's Tuesday. What day is it today? It's Monday. For some reason, I thought it was Wednesday today. You see, this is my problem.
Oh. Yeah, and also, the clocks have changed in the UK, but they have not changed in America. So it's now 7 hours different.
And that is the most annoying thing in the world, that two-week period where America and Britain are out of sync.
But they're closer to us. That's a good thing.
That's better because I'm travelling home. Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you know that 48% of the UK population put their clocks back an hour and the other 52% put them back 60 years?
Oh, see, you so should have been on the Brexit episode. So, I mean,
Rachel,
Andy,
and I have done our own exit. Brexit,
I bet you have. So what did you guys, Andy, I couldn't resist when I saw that article about the fact that Apple have increased the price of all of their products in the UK because of the exchange rate. I just had to leave it on Twitter and wait for you to react. It was so funny.
It didn't take long, did it?
No. Have you got like this notification when anybody says anything Brexit related, it causes a ping?
No, I only have notifications when you say something, Paul.
See, I feel special now. So, yeah, I mean, that was a bit outrageous, mine, wasn't it? Well, it wasn't. It's the consequence of the decision that we made as a country, I guess. Silence from Andy.
Yeah, do you know what? I'm trying not to get upset. It doesn't do my blood pressure any good. The doctors told me not to talk about Brexit.
You would have never been able to tell that from you on Twitter recently. You've been horrendous.
I can't help it. I cannot help it if 52% of our fellow British people are complete and utter blithering imbeciles without the brains that they were born with.
I was going to say you heard it here first, but you haven't heard it here first. You've heard it continually from Andy on Twitter.
I can't help it. I think I've lost a lot of friends because of my anti-Brexit leave voting rants. But, you know, hey, not my fault. Idiots.
So, I mean, talking of Brexit and Apple and things like that, we can't not talk about the new Macs, can we? I mean, it would just be wrong. So let's start with you, Marcus, right? The most, out of all of us, probably the less tech-obsessed. Is that a fair assumption of you? You don't get quite as drooly as the rest of us over technology. I'll be interested to hear what you thought of the latest set of announcements.
Just a bit stupid, really. A bit Brexity of them.
In what regard?
The fact that they've yet again not bothered to put useful ports on the machine. That's one that basically the reason why this is at the forefront of my mind is one of our developers, Ian, has been waiting to upgrade his MacBook Pro for about a year now. I'll wait till the new ones come out. And then it comes out and it's like, okay, so it's quite pretty then, but it's a lot more expensive and it doesn't really... Oh, and it's got a touch bar. That's a nice thing, isn't it, if you're a developer?
Well, it kind of... just to play devil's advocate, and I'm not convinced by this in any way, surely... Perhaps this is a question for Rachel. Surely developers who spend all their time on the keyboard and don't like touching mice, you know, and we kind of rely on keyboard shortcuts. Surely the touch bar is a huge boon for your ilk, Rachel.
But you'd have to look at it. I don't look at the keyboard. And also, I don't use my Mac keyboard. I'm sat here in a hotel room. I've got my Mac up on a rooster stand and I've got an external Bluetooth keyboard and an external trackpad. And that's what I use. You know, and most other people, I think a lot of designers will have their Mac closed and they've got it plugged into an external monitor. Or it's up on a stand and they're using it as a second monitor. I mean, who's using this thing? It just seems like a gimmick to me. I was hoping for new iMacs, to be honest, because my iMac at home is on its last legs. And actually, the whole issue has prompted me to think, well, maybe it's time for a change back to PC across the board. Not as a gut reaction thing, but just as a kind of like, this is very expensive hardware. I've had a run of bad luck with Macs anyway. I've had real problems with Mac hardware recently. There's some very nice Windows devices out there.
Oh, there are. I mean, that the new, probably not so much for you, Rachel, but the new Surface, you know, with the dialy thing and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. I mean, that's a kind of designer's dream. Andy, surely you must have been drooling over that one.
He's gone.
He's left. He's forgotten to turn his mic on. That's what happened.
No, yeah. I was muted just according to instructions. I sat there because don't forget that I couldn't watch the keynote live because of time zones and stuff. So I woke up the following morning and then, you know, watched what everybody else had seen. And I thought that I'd woken up in some kind of parallel universe because the previous day I'd been thinking, oh, that Surface Pro or whatever it's called, the Surface Studio looks really cool. You know, as a, if I was an illustrator, and I could lay the thing down like a kind of a plan or draft table, it looks fantastic. Mm. And the dialy thing, you know, for zooming into Photoshop and all that kind of stuff looked bloody brilliant. So I did tweet something along the lines of, you know, Apple better do something sexy, in their keynote the next day. And, you know, they didn't. And, I thought that, you know, 80% of what they did show was kind of filler. After all this time, only to show off a MacBook Pro and not a new kind of desktop or little, you know, an upgrade to the regular MacBook or something like that. And the things that they have done to and taken away from that MacBook Pro, I actually use them all the time. The number of times that the MagSafe adapter has saved my machine. And, you know, that's gone. And I really use the SD card adapter a lot.
Yeah, I do. Mm.
You know, so I just think, well, I do hope that this isn't kind of like the beginning of the, you know, the rot setting in.
Why do we think this is the case, though? Is it them being super clever and trying to save money and they have a plan that if they don't make these as good as everybody wants them, then they're going to buy other things and we'll have more Apple devices on our desks and that's what they want? Or is it just bad decision-making? Not that I expect anyone to know that, but...
I mean, based on the touch bar, it does make me wonder how many people they've actually asked. You know, I didn't see that people were screaming out for that. It's a very confusing one for me.
I honestly just think they've lost their way. I think they've lost, you know, I think they were a company that was driven by a single individual and a vision of a single individual. And I don't think they've managed to maintain that ruthless focus that Steve Jobs bought. I mean, just look at the lineup itself. I mean, they've cleaned it up a little bit. By dropping the Air, which was a somewhat redundant, but there's kind of, they've tried to literally fill every price point and every, item all of the way up. And as a result, I think they've overstretched themselves. I think they're not putting the attention into the you know, they've basically abandoned desktops entirely, haven't they?
Yeah, I mean, that's what worries me. I mean, I was hoping to see a commitment to hardware and hardware for pro users with that keynote, and that was kind of what I was waiting to see, and I don't think we've got that. I think that the features they've added to the MacBook Pro are much more for, really, for home users with money.
yeah.
I mean, that's what it feels like. It feels like, you know, this is a nice thing for people who can afford it and like, you know, little gimmicky features. You know, it's underpowered compared to some of the competition. You know, I mean, I mean, my Mac really is a shiny container for virtual machines. That's, you know, I run a load of virtual machines. That's, I do all my development in Linux VMs. And, you know, I want power. I want to be able to run a load of those things without messing around with them.
I just got, sorry, they've dropped the Air. I didn't know that.
Yes, they have.
Yeah. Because, I mean, essentially, you've got now the MacBook, at the which is the Air equivalent.
With no ports on it, yeah.
With no ports on it. Then you've got the MacBook without the touch bar. Then you've got the 13-inch MacBook with the touch bar, and then the 15-inch MacBook with the touch bar. And so the ports are gone, Marcus. There is no way back from the ports. You are portless. That is just the way that they're going. And I'm kind of fine with that if you had something like, for example, I'll be honest, you know, we're all sitting here slamming it, but I've ordered the new MacBook Pro. And the reason that I've done it is simply because I've got a very, very old MacBook Pro, which is beginning to struggle with anything that's, you know, related to, you know, design or video editing and that kind of stuff. And I haven't got on very well with having two separate machines. So I've gone for this new MacBook Pro. But as a result, I've also had to buy a new monitor because my cinema display was on the way out. And even if it wasn't on the way out, it was incompatible with the, you know, these new ports. But the nice thing about the new monitor, and this goes back to your point, Marcus, I'm fine with there not being ports as long as I can plug a single cable into a monitor or a docking station or something like that and then have all my peripherals plugged into that. That's kind of okay for me. I wouldn't say it's perfect, but it's okay for me. But then you've got Apple going, well, we're not going to build monitors either. And we're not providing any kind of docking solution. So it's just, yeah. Go on, Andy. You're itching to say something. I can sense it.
No, just a bit of real time follow up because I'm looking at the, well, this is the Australian Apple store, so maybe things are a bit different down here. But they have actually dropped the 11-inch MacBook Air, but the 13-inch MacBook Air is still available.
Oh, see, that just shows you how messy their lineup is. It's like it's all over the place. And then you've got nothing on the monitor side, nothing on the you know, iMac. Very peculiar. Have we exhausted our ranting on this?
Is all I
can
say.
Yes, I think so.
So other than Rachel, would anybody else think about switching away from Apple?
If there was an alternative to Sketch that wasn't Adobe Illustrator, potentially, or if Sketch was available for Windows, I may give it a look.
Mm. Sam, what about you? You've been very quiet through all of this.
Well, that's because as a project manager kind of person, I can probably do my job on a brick with a chip in it, to be honest. I mean, I wasn't really into Apple products until I joined a couple of companies ago. So I've only been using it about 5 years. Before that, I was Windows, and I didn't really have a problem with it. It just seems it's getting less and less each year as well. That's probably something to note as well. It just seems like you say that they've just sort of lost it, but it is slowing down as well. You know, so I mean, I would consider it. I've kind of invested in Apple now, really, but there's nothing new that even interests me, and all the stuff I have now is working fine.
And that's the trouble, what you said there. I've invested in Apple now. You kind of get sucked into the ecosystem. Exactly. So I think about all the cost of all of the bits of software that I would need to replace and, you know, all the rest of it. And it's quite an intimidating prospect, isn't it, really?
Yeah, it is. It is. But, I think maybe people will last one more round and then I think it could change a lot.
I do, especially if Microsoft keep coming out with really cool stuff like they seem to have started to do recently. And also their operating system doesn't suck quite as much as it used to.
No, I installed Windows 10 for my dad only a couple of weeks ago, and I was pleasantly surprised. They've kind of taken a good few lessons there. They've got all the nasty stuff behind the scenes if you want to access it that way, but they've put this nice little layer over it. It's not too bad, not too bad.
Right, let's push on from that. Now we had to talk about it. I didn't feel we had any choice, but we've done it to death now, so let's move on and talk about our first sponsor, which is VideoBlocks. As you will have known if you listened to previous shows, VideoBlocks is an affordable subscription-based stock media site that gives you unlimited access to premium stock footage. But also, VideoBlocks has a sister site, AudioBlocks, which offers, as you might guess from the name, unlimited access to premium stock audio sounds. So you get both of them work on this subscription basis. So basically, it's got amazing value because you can get unlimited downloads on both of these services. So they've got a great selection of over 115,000 videos and 130,000 audio files. And their average subscriber ends up paying effectively less than $1 a download over a year because, you know, you're subscribed to it and you download so much. And there's great variety of really good high quality video and audio, and they're always adding new stuff, and you can use it in whatever way that you want. Now, VideoBlocks, we've had an offer the last couple of weeks, but they've come up with an even better bundle, in my opinion, which is where they bundled VideoBlocks and AudioBlocks together for $149 over the year. So that's a $100 discount off the usual price tag for people that listen to this show. So if you're doing a lot with audio or video files, which increasingly most of us are these days, then go check it out. You can find out more and get that offer at videoblocks.com/BoagWorld2016. So there we go. That brings us on to our discussion topic for the day. And actually, I want to kick off with you, Sam, if I can, because I think yours is an absolutely brilliant topic and one that I think a lot of listeners need to hear. So do you want to introduce that?
Yeah. So I'd like to talk about imposter syndrome. So for anyone listening that hasn't heard of it, I'll sort of quote from Wikipedia just to clear it up. It refers to high-achieving individuals with a marked an inability to internalize their accomplishments and a persistent fear of being exposed as a fraud. So now, I didn't even know this was a thing until probably a couple of years ago. But once I heard it and read about it, it was like, bang, you know, that explained an awful lot of feelings that I'd had for probably well over a decade, I think. Elaborating more on the definition slightly, the quote indicates that, as I say, the worst sufferers are high-performing, competent people, and it manifests itself in several ways. So, and it sounds crazy. I mean, listen to it. It's really strange. So it says, high-performing people often work hard in order to prevent people from discovering that they are imposters. Mm-hmm. This hard work often leads to more praise and success, which perpetuates the imposter feelings and fears of being found out. The imposter person might feel they need, you know, to work two or three times as hard. So they over-prepare, tinker, and they obsess over details and so on. And of course, that can lead to burnout, sleep deprivation, you name it. And then as a direct result of the career progression, and it sounds a bit Batman, but with greater responsibility comes, like Spider-Man, isn't it? With greater responsibility comes internal doubt as the cost of failure gets higher and higher.
Mm.
And it's just a fascinating, fascinating thing that I didn't know it was a thing, as I say, for a couple of years. And you think by knowing what something is, if you suffer with it, it would ease the problem. But that's not what I found at all. So really, I'm going to use this panel as my self-help group and ask them if you know, if any of you have experienced it or still do, if you've got any advice on conquering it, and especially as people that sort of lead teams, you know, how do you help people on your teams that suffer with it?
Rachel, you look like you want to kick off.
Okay, well, I'm sat here this afternoon. I'll be doing my brand new An Event Apart talk. The imposter syndrome is kind of like doing cartwheels around this hotel room right now. I don't think it gets any better. As you say, I think the more the best you're doing in your sort of career, then the more you think, oh, you know, at some point, someone's going to find out that I'm actually an idiot.
Yeah, definitely.
I think you see, I don't know, because I always used to put it down to the fact that I'm completely self-taught. You know, I've got no qualifications behind me. But you'd think by this point, you know, I'm an invited expert at the CSS working group. There's various people ask me to come and speak at these conferences. You know, I must know something about what I'm talking about. And yet there's still in the back of my mind, like, what if I say something really stupid and then everybody realizes that I'm a fool? And that's basically where it comes from. It's like,
it's a fear of failure, I guess. It's the only thing I can put it down to.
Yeah, it is. It's a fear of, it's a weird thing. And I think it, because actually I could say something completely ridiculous in my talk today. I could, you know, completely misinterpret something, say something nonsensical. Someone will call me out on it. A few people will call me a fool. I'll post some code and say, oh yes, you know, look, I got this wrong. Here's a correction to that. Everyone will have forgotten about it in 2 days. Mm. I wouldn't forget about it, of course. That would just underline the fact that I'm an idiot. but you know, I mean, it's like actually this imposter syndrome thing, there's actually no, you know, so when you sort of think, oh, what's the worst that could happen? Well, the worst that could happen is that you're wrong about something or you do a bad presentation or whatever. But that's actually not the end of the world. And yet you kind of make it out to feel like it might be.
Yeah, it doesn't. I mean, I go through exactly the same emotions and it just doesn't seem to help. I mean, I think things that have helped me maybe it really obviously recognizing what it is and believing that I'm competent. But it's very, you know, it's really tricky because at the same time, I don't ever want to be sort of believing my own hype. You know, it's a really tricky balance because you can go too far the other way and I'd probably become someone that I think I'd rather have imposter syndrome than be that person. I mean, I've spoken to people, even like yourself, Paul, at times that, you know, looking at you doing your talks and wondering, you know, how you did it without getting nervous. And you do. And I've seen speakers on stage who they're given a talk and it's just blown me away. They're so powerful. And I won't name names, but I've seen the same speaker, you know, down the sort of side of a building 5 minutes after the talk, hyperventilating. And you suddenly realize that this thing is everywhere. And yet no one knows how to make it any better.
There's a difference, though, between getting nervous, you know, before or after a talk, or, you know, wondering whether you or not you can, you know, you've achieved your full potential and, you know, whether you've got it all right, and what people think of generally as imposter syndrome, which is, you know, really quite a sort of strange psychological phenomenon. And one of the things that some people know about me is that I actually know quite a lot about comedians. And is anybody familiar with Michael Barrymore, the comic?
Oh, yeah.
The TV show host?
Yeah.
Barrymore is a classic example of this because the guy is, you know, a very high-functioning genius. And his talent was always to be able to find that one little thing when he was interviewing somebody on Strike It Lucky or whatever it would be, and then kind of hone in on that one thing on the spur of the moment and mercilessly tease them about it. The guy was a comedy genius, and yet psychologically was always thinking that, well, you know, he wasn't good enough, that he was about to be found out, that his career was going to end. And it became a self-fulfilling prophecy for the poor guy. Mm. And, you know, there is this kind of classic thing in creative people, where of course nothing's good enough. It's never going to be good enough. That's kind of the point. When it comes down to creative work, so there is this kind of difference, I think, between this sort of internalized checking and just generally being kind of, you know, not confident. You know, not everybody's confident to get up on stage, or, you know, everybody gets kind of full of nerves. But I think that's sort of something slightly different.
I think I am a genuine imposter. I think because of the way I started my career in a completely different industry, and the thing that I kind of studied my ass off when I was a teenager has nothing to do with what I'm doing now. And yet I kind of, I'm okay. I can deal with it because my character isn't, I'm not a worrier. So I kind of, you know, I can deal with it quite well, but I feel that I will never be an accepted part of this industry because I'm not a designer, I'm not a coder. I just think that applies to quite a lot of people in our industry because a lot of us have come from somewhere else, and that certainly describes me.
But yeah. The question there is, well, and probably a big part of the problem is, what makes you an imposter.
Yeah.
Who, you know, you say that you're an imposter, you're choosing to define yourself as an imposter. Because from my perspective, you know, you've been working in the digital field, what since 2000 and something?
Me, 1999. Yeah.
1999. Now, that's way longer than the vast majority of people in the industry. So in that sense, you're not really an imposter. You're no more an imposter than anybody else. It's how you choose to define yourself. And you're choosing to define yourself as an outsider. In the same way as my manifestation of this is that that I feel like I'm a bullshitter, right? And I'm very my talent is being very good at bullshitting. But if my bullshit and what I'm saying as I'm bullshitting is actually helping people, then surely it has a value to it. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I've got a long track record of doing, you know, being part of a team that does good work for clients over and over and over and over again. So, yeah, I've got to bring some value to the table. Otherwise, I would have dropped out years ago. But it's just the kind of black and white nature of I did that thing and it stopped. And then I've picked up this other thing. And yeah, 20 years later, almost, I can, you know, I accept I'm kind of intelligent enough to work out that I'm not really an imposter anymore, but I don't think the feeling is ever going to go away, but I can deal with it. It's all right.
But the thing is, I mean, what I notice is that I don't think I felt this early in my career. I was just excited to be doing it. You know, it was only when I started to write or started to speak or started to, as I said, get promotions, that it suddenly seemed to be the thing that changed for me. So I remember being at university and I would always think I'd sort of failed an exam or something, and it turns out I didn't. But it really took hold once I think the failure would be perceived as worse by me, though, not by anybody else. Really.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, that's I think there's a couple of things. I think partly, you know, this industry, people are very vocal if they think that someone hasn't done something well or is always saying something that's nonsense, and there's lots of opinion flies around, you know. So I think that for people who are doing well in the web industry, they're exposed to an awful lot of potential criticism that doesn't really happen in other industries, you know, unless you're kind of like a very high-profile celebrity. You know, you know, I'm sort of a little bit famous in my corner of the world, you know, of CSS, you know, or whatever, which exposes me to far more kind of stuff coming back at me than if I was, you know, in lots of other fields, was equally sort of high profile.
Do we know that's true, mine, Rachel? I mean,
well, I
don't know if you're a
medical
dermatologist.
Yeah, because, you know, I know people who are in the medical profession who are, you know, sort of very high profile in that. You know, it's not a case of you're going to open up your computer and look at a social media platform and see 100 tweets telling you that you're an idiot, or, you know, in my case, mansplaining something to me, or, you know, or whatever. You know, that doesn't happen in other industries. Yes, you might get criticized, you know, academically or what have you, but I think the very direct nature of it in this industry, for people who actually aren't that high profile, and you know, you could have 200 Twitter followers, but say something that gets picked up and gets sort of retweeted everywhere, and suddenly have this huge onslaught of people telling you you're an idiot. You know, then that, I don't think that so much happens, not so publicly. And I think there is a big element of kind of public, you know, kind of being worried about kind of almost being shamed in public for something. I think does, particularly if you have a bit of profile, because that's important to you. It's important to your career.
Go on, Andy.
Can I recommend a really good book that I read in its entirety on the plane out to Australia a couple of weeks ago? It's called Have You Been Publicly Shamed by Ron Johnson. And it does actually talk about a couple of the things that Rachel has just mentioned. And it's a brilliant book. It's really well written. And I'd recommend it very strongly.
The other thing you could check out is the latest season of Black Mirror, which looks at this as an issue, that probably won't cheer you up quite as much. The other thing, I think one of the problems with social media, right, is the you know, especially as time goes on and you get more followers behind you, right? So, you know, when you've got thousands and thousands of people following you, if you make a mistake, then all of those people, or a big percentage of those people, are going to respond to you. And even if it's something quite trivial, I'll give you an example, typos, right? Or spelling mistakes. I'm always making spelling mistakes on a blog post, right? So, and somebody very helpfully tweets me saying, oh, just to let you know, there's a spelling mistake on that. And that's fine. But when 50, 100, 150 people are all telling you the same thing, then it starts to get magnified in your mind. And that's what really drags you down and really makes you paranoid, is that kind of repetition of something again and again, or at least that's what gets to me.
So, I mean, has anyone got any tips? I mean, for the listeners, for me, for everyone, really. I mean, has anyone found that they have experienced it and eased it even by a percent? I think everyone would be interested in that.
I don't think I've managed to ease it. I think what I tend to do is I collect the sort of the positive stuff that people say, not in a kind of, not just people sort of saying, oh, that was a marvelous talk, but like when someone directly says, you know, that really helped me solve this particular problem in work today, or, you know, your book was the thing that got me started. And I try and collect bits and pieces like that just to remind myself, because I think you always focus on the negative stuff.
So you're sort of taking away the vanity of both positive and negative and focusing on the real substantial feedback.
Yeah, the substantial, because, I mean, it's easy for people just to say, oh, you know, that was a great talk or whatever, and they like you, so they say, you know, say nice things, and, that's great. But, you know, it's that actual, the real stuff, that, you know, where I can see that I've actually really helped someone, or, you know, I've managed to make a difference with that. And I think, well, you know, I'm not doing a bad job if I'm managing to do that. And for me, that's what it's all about. That's what talking and writing and things is about. It's about helping other people learn about this stuff.
Yeah.
And so I try and circle back to that when I'm feeling, oh, you know, I'm terrible. You know, like, no, you know, I've managed to help these people, and I'll be able to help some more people with this stuff.
Good advice.
I tend to look at people I respect and admire, and when I discover that they suffer from imposter syndrome too, you know, when you can find that out, then that's reassuring. You know, if Jeffrey Zeldman has moments of self-doubt, then surely it's okay for me to, you know, and it shows, well, actually, it can't be a valid feeling, because I know damn well Jeffrey Zeldman is, you know, does amazing work, has been an incredible influence on me, et cetera, et cetera. So if he has that same feeling as me, then the feeling can't be that, you know, worthwhile, or, you know, hasn't got validity to it, if that makes sense.
Sure.
The funniest one I ever had, we'll move on from this, and to be honest, I hope that people that are listening to this, you know, the fact that we've got, you know, Rachel Andrews, Andrew and Andy Clark and Sam Barnes on the show, and they're all suffering from imposter syndrome, hopefully will encourage other people as well. But no, there was one little story I wanted to leave you with before, which was probably my biggest moment of imposter syndrome, where I was giving a presentation at the European Commission. She took me into the room where I was going to be presenting, and it was the room that they do all of the national negotiations in, a massive circular table with all the country names and the flags in each of the places around the table. And then there are banks on either side, you know, all around you, behind, of seating. And people just streamed in, all sitting along this table and all behind it. And they were all kind of a certain age, you know, middle 50s, graying hair. You know, these are super high achiever people. They speak 15 languages. And there I was. And honestly, I've never felt more like a 14-year-old boy in my life. You know, I was giggling on the inside, slightly hysterically, at the fact that these people were listening to me.
Did you have your Union Jack suit on?
No, I didn't actually, which I think is probably a good, I'm never wearing that to Europe again now. I think that's just dead as a jacket, unfortunately, because of the way things have gone. So anyway, let's move on. We're never going to cover all of the topics again, but I'm just letting them run as long as they do now. I wanted to talk about Marcus's topic, because I think this is a really interesting one as well, which is a long time in discussion Marcus, you think that maybe things have shifted a little bit? We're talking about designers and coding and that kind of stuff. So what made you bring this conversation up again?
Last week I had a couple of days away with one of our designers, Ed. We were doing a sort of 2-day workshop up in East Anglia. And as you do, you end up in the pub and start chatting about stuff. And this was a subject that Ed brought up. He's a designer. I'm going to have to say that this isn't really my subject for the show. I'm supposed to talk about kind of businessy stuff, but it was an interesting point that sort of raised an eyebrow and made me think, oh, really? I hadn't thought of that. I didn't think this was a thing, because obviously 5-10 years ago, the discussions that we were having on this show were very much around the idea that if you're a designer, then you need to know how to code to be able to do it properly, in a nutshell. Mm-hmm. And Ed wasn't saying you don't need to be able to code, but he felt that the quality required to produce production code is maybe, and he wasn't saying it's a black and white thing, but he was saying that maybe that's something that he doesn't necessarily, it's not something he should be doing. He should be concentrating on being a designer rather than concentrating on being a kind of top flight front end developer, I guess. Mm-hmm. And that maybe that the two, you know, the two kind of tasks, if you like, have gone off in different directions, inevitably so, probably. And I guess from a kind of business point of view, somebody that runs an agency, it made me think, oh, okay, so, you know, in the future, if we need to employ people, then we need to be considering, you know, maybe a kind of more definite roles than kind of, you know, jack of all trade kind of roles that we have done in the past. And it was just an interesting point that I thought, I hadn't thought of that, and I thought that would be potentially a good a subject of discussion for this show. And just if anybody thinks that is true, that you know, being able to do both to the highest quality is asking too much of people, maybe.
I think things have changed massively over the last 5 or 10 years. I mean, you know, idiots like me used to be able to actually write code for websites. And, you know, they could go live. I could write the HTML and the CSS and a little bit of, you know, a jQuery plugin here and there. But things have just changed massively and have got more technical. I think there's more involved in actually writing production code, and you know, there's the performance issues and you know, whether or not things are compiled or grunt or gulp or god knows all this kind of stuff that I have no idea what it means. And actually, do you know what, I think it's probably okay that I don't know how to do that stuff now, but I still need to be able to actually convey my designs in markup and CSS in some form or another. You know, it doesn't have to be the best code. Somebody else will write that. But what is important is that I can take my design, even if I've made that design up in Sketch in the first instance, which I still do a lot of, and, you know, I get it in to HTML and CSS, and I can look at it on my phone or look at it on an iPad or whatever, and, you know, adjust the typographic scale and do all the kind of stuff that I need to do. But then hand it over to, you know, Joe, our developer, and he can, you know, actually do the proper stuff that hits the client's browser.
Yeah, I'm quite interested in this because I'm very interested generally in layout, and a lot of the stuff I've been talking about is to do with sort of modern layout methods. And I think particularly with grid layout, we're going to end up in a position where sort of visual design tools for the web are going to be far more of a possibility. Now, I don't think that those things are going to be able to create marvellous production code. I think there's always going to be a level of needing to take output of something like that and turn it into really robust production code that deals with old browsers and different devices and is really performant. But if we can have visual layout tools for the web which use web technologies that mean that designers can work visually yet output stuff that then they can look at in browsers and they can look at on their phones and things, I don't think this is a bad thing. Because, yeah, it is getting far more complex. It's getting far more complex to build really great production code. And it's a shame if the web becomes simpler because people sort of working within parameters that they understand, rather than just going for it and actually really designing. And with our new layout methods, people should be able to design and do an awful lot more things that we haven't been able to do in the past. And so I'd be really keen to see far more kind of, you know, actual visual tools that use these technologies, not with, when these things appear, people get very upset and they're like, oh, you know, this code's terrible, terrible code, you know, but that's not what it should be about. And there will be people who will shove that straight into production. But I think actually using web code to create interesting design and then handing that over to a developer to say, right, well, this is the kind of the prototype, and let's rebuild it so it's going to be really robust. That's an interesting workflow.
Well, I thought this might be a contentious subject, but it doesn't seem to be. It seems to be that's where we've got to, and maybe I shouldn't have been surprised, but I guess it's because I don't work in that particular area. But yeah, it sounds that we're all in agreement, so not such a good topic.
I think out there on the web, there would be people who get quite upset about that. As I say, you know, you'll see it every time any kind of visual tool shows up, even if it very much is for prototyping. People, you know, feel like it's, you know, it's generating terrible markup and therefore it's a bad thing. I think it's more how these things are used is the bad thing, really.
Yeah, it's like anything, isn't it? It's what you do with it. And like you say, there will be people that will use those tools and push them out as, you know, live, you know, final production code. It's also sometimes about how those tools are presented, you know, and sold. You know, take, for example, Dreamweaver back in the day, where Dreamweaver, you had this visual WYSIWYG element. There was actually nothing wrong with it. I found it quite a handy tool for jumping around in my code and finding a bit of code. I just click on the element that I wanted to edit. So it was quite useful at times. But the problem is that it was being sold as this thing to produce websites, you know, but even then, I mean, is there not an argument? It depends on the kind of websites that you're producing. You know, if you're somebody who produces websites for 500 quid for little small businesses, you know, if the code's terrible, you get what you pay for. Well, is there not an element of that?
There is, yeah. And I think that there's lots of different ways that people are working on the web, and I very much wouldn't want to see that sort of easy entry point into building stuff on the web to go away because it all becomes so complex and you know, you're not allowed to do it. Because the only reason I got to do this stuff is because it was easy to get started. Yeah. And it would be a real shame if we lose all the future people like me who've got a terrible computer and, you know, are just trying to figure out, you know, how to do this and how to publish stuff and how to write HTML. And it would be a shame if we lost that sort of accessibility of this industry by making it all so complex. And yes, people will create terrible code with WYSIWYG tools, but some of them will look at that code and say, hey, this isn't great. I wonder how I can make this better. And then they'll move on from that and they'll start exploring and they'll find out what else is out there. But it's, I think for us as an industry, we shouldn't rubbish those people as they're making their steps in, because their steps in are going to be different from mine, because all there was when I started was HTML. There were no WYSIWYG tools. So now people are coming in differently.
I mean, I started obviously the same as you, where there were no WYSIWYG tools and you had to code everything by hand. But then when there was a period of time when Dreamweaver came along and other tools similar to it, where I stopped coding, you know, and because it became so complicated, you know, with nested tables and all of that and tables within tables, it was easier just to put it together in something like Dreamweaver.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, I think without Dreamweaver, the whole nested table thing would have driven most of us out of the industry again. It was, it was awful.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, it served a great purpose there. And as I say, there are always going to be people who are, you know, just all their web design is editing themes, or you know, they're using WYSIWYG tools or whatever, and that is fine, because as I say, some of those people are then going to look around and say, I think I can probably do something better than this, and they're going to look for the next steps. And I hope that as an industry we're there to take those people on and say, yeah look, you know, this is where you go once you want to move away from, you know, using whatever WYSIWYG. You know, this is your next step. And and be welcoming to that, because that's going to be the routine.
I think that's a really good point, Rachel, because I'm very conscious that, you know, a lot of people that listen to this show are amateur web designers that are doing things in the evening and on weekends. And so much, sometimes we can make things so inaccessible because you've got to do it in the super professional way. And that's so sad, isn't it?
Yeah,
really?
I think we need to make sure we say who we're speaking to when we're talking about certain things. Yeah. If I'm speaking to web professionals, then, you know, I'm very happy to say, no, you should not be using this thing, or you should not be working in this way, because if you're a certain level, then you should be leveling up, basically. But if you're new to the industry, or if you're just taking those first steps, then, you know, we need to be kind to these people, because otherwise they're never going to make it through, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's move on, because I want to get Andy's subject in, simply to ridicule him, really, because Andy has got as a subject, all us designers, we need inspiration budgets. How are you possibly going to justify this bullshit, Andy?
Well, listen, I am not one of these people that thinks that you have to have inspiration to get going in the morning like a bloody cup of coffee, because sometimes, you know, you get to work and you don't want to do the job, and, you know, you've just got to kind of muddle through and do the best of it. So, you know, I'm not a kind of Ponzi designer that thinks that, you know, oh, well, where are you getting your inspiration from today, Andy? But I haven't made much of a secret that I think that web design has become too formulaic. I think I've been fairly clear about that. And part of the reason for this is that few web designers that I talk to look outside of the web for their inspiration. You know, they don't look at magazines, they don't look at newspapers or posters or other media. And I think this is a mistake. So for the past couple of years, I've been building, a fairly inspiring collection of little boutique magazines, you know, and I know that my work has improved because I've got a wider variety of stimuli. I bought so many on a trip recently that Sue's now set me this inspiration budget every month. She won't let me spend lots of money on magazines in magazine shops. So I guess my question is, should employers give designers and, you know, developers and whoever else a regular budget to spend on things that can inspire their work, you know, be that magazines or trips to art galleries or museums or, you know, even trips to the cinema, Don Draper style? Should employers be kind of fostering this creative environment and giving people a budget to, you know, go out there and find it?
I think this is a good one for you to talk about, Marcus, because for a long time at Headscape, we called it a training budget, which is nowhere near as exciting as an inspiration budget. But, you know, that was a similar thinking, was it not?
Yeah. I was going to sort of be flippant there and say, no, everybody should be working very hard all the time.
Yes. Damn them.
Absolutely. We don't do enough of this, and I think we should. So I'm agreeing with you, Andy, because we're quite relaxed, Chris and I, about how everything runs. We're not, you know, hard taskmasters at all. We kind of hope that people will find this inspiration in their own time, and we're quite happy for them to do that. Not, you know, in their own work time, but I think that's an assumption on my part which is wrong, and that we have to say to people, you have this budget or time or whatever it is, use it, because otherwise they won't. So I think it's a good thing, and we don't do enough of that. We've been so blimmin' busy the last year that all of these kind of thoughts about, you know, spending a bit of time thinking about, you know, outside projects and inspiration and stuff like that, and maybe different ways of working, have just gone out the window. It's been kind of niggling me a bit that we've lost that. It's because you're not nagging me, Paul, about these things as you used to. So, yes, I agree. And I think particularly if you're trying to do high quality work, which we always have been and always will be, you need to make sure that the people who are working for you are A, happy, and B, feeling inspired to do the work. So, yeah, a bit of a no-brainer, really. He writes it down on his notepad.
The big one is it's not just about financial budget, is it? It's not just about, you know, here, have a load of money. It's also about having the time to go to museums, to do all of this kind of, even to find the boutique, you know, magazines. It all takes time and it all eats into chargeable time. You know, time people are working onto projects. So, Sam, I mean, from a project manager's point of view, you don't want your members of staff pissing off to the cinema in the middle of the day, do you?
Well, if it's inspiration,
be very careful.
No, I mean, my short answer to this is yes. I think this should happen from a project, and I guess a commercial company perspective. When I've seen this happen, though, there's some interesting downsides that I think anyone thinking about doing it really need to consider how they manage it. So, when we had the ability to give time and the money to certain people, you had to think about the people that weren't getting this in the company. So, you know, mm-hmm. when you're working in a place that doesn't just have, tech and creative, but they have HR, finance, another customer support, that kind of thing. There are instances where it was the education wasn't there for those people to understand why these people had that. And it caused some friction. There's all things like that. I mean, it was also how people use that time and that money. One man's, you know, pocket money is another person's, you know, whatever inspiration. It was very subjective, and it actually caused it. While it's the right thing to do, I think people think put it in place and it will just be fine. Everything will be great. But there's all these little other areas that have nothing to do with, you know, anything other than human beings that really need to be considered to actually get leverage the value out of that budget, because it could possibly be counterproductive.
Of course, the best thing that people can do is to let their employees buy action figures and have those around the walls.
Well, yeah. I, as somebody that has also done that, I couldn't agree with you more, Andy.
I find them every very time inspiring.
Every time you look up from your desk, you're confronted by somebody else's creativity. And also, Andy, I've heard you on more than one occasion on Twitter, essentially, you know, saying to your apes, you know, come on, we're going to have a good day. So there you go.
I think this is, it's just... There is another view you can take from this, that grown men who have action figures around them are actually quite worrying.
Now that's contentious, Marcus.
No, you can't agree with that.
Well, my problem with that statement, Marcus, is the idea that there is such a thing as a grown man. I think we are inherently childlike, and I think it's very sad when we don't still embrace our desire to play, because it is through play that you discover and do new things.
You're reading off a page, Paul.
That is why you, Marcus, are so restrained and so uncreative, like a dried up old husk.
Yes, that'll be it, Paul, definitely.
My therapist asked me once how old I thought I was, and I said 12, and she replied, that old?
That's a true story, isn't it?
It is actually a very true story.
Yeah. I thought it was.
Isn't that interesting, though? Because we have this, you know, how old do you feel, that kind of thing. I think I'm 18, so I'm obviously ancient and a grown-up compared to you.
No, I would say about 12.
In my mind, mentally. I am 18 years old, and I look in the mirror and go...
Have you noticed how, you know, Rachel's mic has just been turned off? She's keeping well out of this conversation.
Dignified silence.
Yes. Yeah, that's what it is. No, I don't really... despite the fact that in my past I've been a choreographer, I don't particularly see myself as a very creative person. I'm kind of, as I say, I don't even wait, like even with writing and things, I'm very much a kind of, I will just sit down and I will write that 2,000 words, and they might be rubbish, but that's fine. That's a starting point. I can go back over it. I don't kind of wait for it. There's no waiting for anything to strike. I don't have time for it.
I'm the same writing, actually.
Yeah, I'm pretty much with everything. I'll just, you know, I just do it. And maybe that, you know, it. I guess if I spent more time thinking about this stuff, or I don't know, I don't know, maybe I could be more creative. But I don't see myself in that sort of role anymore.
But I mean, you must still have to invest in training and staying up to date with stuff. So is that, do you do that by you know, do you set some money aside and go and do something or buy something? Or do you, is it that you just spend time fiddling?
No, I mean, I think it's, I mean, partly, obviously, the stuff I do around, say, new CSS things, I don't get paid for that. I don't get paid for being on the CSS working group. You know, that's essentially like my weird hobby. So I guess that stuff is, because to me, the big thing about being, say, on the CSS working group or being a Google developer expert or, you know, these, it means I'm exposed to other people who I think are far brighter than I am. And yeah. I get to talk to them and I get to, you know, I get to contribute as well, which is pretty cool. But I can actually have these discussions with people. And that, I guess that is my inspiration, is putting myself in these places where there are people who, or maybe I only understand half of what they're saying, but, you know, but it informs me and it helps me to think of new ideas around code, and around, you know, sort of new CSS or whatever that I wouldn't have otherwise if I wasn't exposed to those people and those conversations. You know, like I know nothing about how to develop, you know, a browser rendering engine, for instance, but I get to hang out with people who do. They write that code. And to me, that's fascinating. I know so much more about how that actually works now, and that then informs the sort of stuff that I might try to do or, you know, or try to demonstrate to people. So I guess that's kind of my take on this, is that time I spend and being with the people who can really inform that.
Yeah, it's being inspired by smart people, which is always a good approach. I mean, that would come on brilliantly to the topic that you wanted to talk about, which is this idea of contributing to open standards and stuff like that. But I am really sorry, Rachel, we need to wrap up this week's show, but we should definitely get onto that next week, because it's a fascinating area.
Pick that up next week.
You're around next week, are you?
I believe so. I think I am actually in one place. I shall check. But yes, I think I might be back in the UK by then.
Well, if not, whenever you're next on the show, I definitely want to talk about that, because I actually think that is a really, you know, really important subject to cover. Okay, so let's just do our final sponsor for the day, and then we shall wrap this baby up. Our final sponsor is Currency Fair, where you can save 80% on international transfer fees and exchange rates. I'm about to use this myself, actually. I haven't quite got around to doing it yet, because I've got this big chunk of money sitting in PayPal that is in dollars. And so instead of, transferring that through PayPal, they're going to give me a rubbish rate and they screw you over. I'm going to try and do that via Currency Fair instead, because they've got none of this kind of getting commission out of a bad, you know, exchange rate, which is like so many organizations do this and it just drives me nuts. So Currency Fair, on the other hand, have got an average rate of 0.35% above the kind of base rate, the rate that you would see on Google if you did a search on rates. And their rate is constantly live. It's always updating based on whatever the current exchange rate is. And you can go to their homepage and actually see the rate and what it is. And you can set it up so it either transfers immediately across or you can say, you can set your own rate and say, well, when the rate hits this, then transfer at that point, which is what is exactly what I'm going to be doing. There are many different types of people that use Currency Fair in lots of different situations, but one that's quite common is moving abroad. So somebody I know has recently moved across to Australia, and it would be great for handling the transfer of something massive like the sale of a property, or even when you still have some bills back in the UK, you can manage all of that kind of stuff. So there's lots of scenarios where it might be useful. If that is you, go and check out currencyfair.com/BOAG, BOAG. So that about wraps up this week's show. Marcus, do you have a joke for us?
I have Lee's joke from last week that he didn't get to tell. And I'm saying that because then you can blame him, not me, for a change. Here we go. My friend recently got crushed by a pile of books. He's only got his shelf to blame.
God. Oh, that's so... Why do I do this?
So there you go. Let's do a quick round table and we'll say where people can find out more about you. Andy, where can people find out more about you?
They can have a look at my website at stuffandnonsense.co.uk, or you can look at me on Twitter.
Okay, which is malarkey, isn't it?
M-A-L-A-R-K-E-Y.
And Sam, what about you?
My site is thesambarns.com and Twitter the same, at thesambarns.
And Rachel?
I'm at Rachel Andrew on Twitter and rachelandrew.co.uk on the interwebs.
And finally, Marcus.
Headscape.co.uk and at Marcus67.
So there you go. So thank you, everybody, for joining us this week on the show. And thank you for listening. We will be back again next week. But until then, bye-bye.
Oh,